everyone. My name is Lear. I'm one of the librarians here at Teenscape. Welcome to our next edition of Career Conversations, Working in Theater. Quick notes, please silence cell phones. Bathrooms are right outside down the way, and you may be in some photos. I may jump up to take photos this way, like the back of your head will be in photos. Let's get started. Please help me to welcome. We have Matthew Paul Olmos, award-winning playwright, and Bernardo Cubría, award-winning playwright and actor, and Andy Lowe, director of production of East West Players. So how we do this here is I'll start with the questions, get it rolling, and then I like to take audience questions. So especially volunteers, let's get some questions going. All right, let's start. First, welcome. Thank you all so much for taking time out of your Saturday to do this. We are recording for podcast, so your questions will be on our podcast. So I like to just start with the path you've taken to get to where you are today in terms of schooling, internships, things like that.
So I actually started my senior year of undergrad. I switched majors to theater because I took a playwriting class just kind of on a lark. And it really took to me, and I sort of knew, I just felt like I had a connection to it, then like something I'd never had before. And so I immediately jumped into grad school. So I went the grad school route. I went and got my MFA at the Actors Studio, New School for Drama in New York. And then I basically just stayed there. And I started an indie theater company. I interned at a Manhattan Theater Club. And then I began as a staffer at the Lark Play Development Center, which is a laboratory for playwrights in New York. And then at a certain point, my own career started to sort of take off a bit, and then I didn't have time for the full-time work. So in like 2012, I lipped over and started just doing playwriting full-time. And that's basically what I do now. So
I came at playwriting kind of as an accident. I'm an actor, and I moved to New York after college. I went to theater school to be an actor. And then just because things were slow and I wasn't booking some acting stuff, I decided to start writing at home. And then the more and more I did that, the more and more that I liked it. But I didn't do grad school. I didn't do all of that. I mean, most of the people that I've met and gotten my playwriting opportunities from have been because of my acting and because of getting to know theater people that way. So it's not at all a path that anyone should follow.
Yeah, I think that's going to be the running theme, right, for this, is that none of us necessarily probably ended up where we thought we would, because it's not really a linear path, right? I mean, so my thing was, I actually thought I was going to do visual art. I was planning to do like graphic novels, storyboarding, concept design for like theme parks. And I ended up at, because of that, I started doing a lot of writing. I ended up having a play that I wrote in high school was selected for production by the Old Globe for a young California Young Playwrights Project. And then I went to school just because I can be an art major, and ended up in a really crappy art program that really wasn't doing what I like. I literally just was the nerd who wanted to like sit there and crosshatch all day. They were not into that. They just wanted me to look at Duchamp's urinal and, you know, do a lot of like, you know, performance-based sculpture, which was not what I was into at all. So I ended up in the theater program because I met the theater design instructor there, Ron Ranson, who got me into his first kind of design class, and that was really much like closer to what I was looking for, because it was placemaking, it was design, it was, you know, much more nuts and bolts. It was more like how do you storytell through design. And then from there it went to lighting design, and of course, having done some playwriting in the past, eventually the playwriting, and then eventually I ran out of all the other classes that I could take that wasn't acting. So then I ended up acting, and then I started acting, and then I'm like, wow, I'm Asian. They aren't going to cast me in anything. So I started an Asian American theater company, and then I started to apply all these other random skills that I was picking up while I was freelancing at La Jolla Playhouse and the Old Globe and the San Diego Rep, and doing stuff with my own small company, and, you know, still going to school crazy, and then like had an agent in LA and in San Diego and was driving back and forth. So it was crazy. Let's stop everything. Let's cool off. Let's choose a thing. And right now I'm a production manager, so I'm producing primarily. Still would consider myself a director first. But it's never a linear path, right?
Wonderful, thank you. Can any of you, do any of you have a favorite school you could recommend? I know you had some bad experiences. You don't have to name it if you don't want to. But any particular schools? I know you went to UC Santa Barbara. Is that a particularly good school for playwriting? Or
I would say, you know, in terms of undergrad, I think, you know, I think wherever, I don't think there's a huge difference, maybe undergrad where you go, at least for playwriting, I mean, but for grad school, you know, unless you're going to like a Yale or a Juilliard, those are schools that really will put you afterwards and place you somewhere. You'll get an agent pretty quickly. You might get a show at a prominent theater. Other schools, you can actually learn quite a lot. That's where I went also. But I think at this point in time, a lot of them can't do much for you outside. Like their sort of professional development isn't anywhere close to the level of like a Yale or like a Juilliard. So like a lot of kids when they're thinking about applying, I'm always sort of saying like, unless it's paid for and it's free, it's a lot of things to consider because they might not be able to help you in a bigger way after school's over. So.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I agree with Matt. I think that unless it's like Yale or maybe Columbia or Juilliard, that those are schools that set you up afterward and that you can have easier access to sort of the bigger agencies. And there's a sort of network that really takes care of one another. Like we joke, people who've lived in New York, about the Yale Mafia. It's a real thing. Watch out. If you can get in it, get in it. But I think mostly I would go to a school where I can write as much as possible and that gives me the freedom to produce my work, even if it's at a lower level. The school that I went to was University of Houston, which is not a renowned theater school, but why I loved it was my friends and I were like, oh, you guys only do white plays. Can we use the smaller theater and put on our brown plays? And they were like, sure, yeah, do whatever you want. And they got out of our way and they let us fail and create our own stuff. And that was where I learned the most.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, something just kind of to add on to what they're saying too, right, is that I think there's kind of maybe three methodologies you choose a school for theater, right? One is where you're getting your kind of fundamental, right? Where you're just, you're learning kind of your core, like your craft, your acting, your writing, whatever, or if you're doing technical work or design, right? And then there's kind of career launching, right? And that's kind of when you're at the kind of the grad school or conservatory level, right? Because those are where you're, it's not even just kind of, you know, like the idea, like everyone says networking or, you know, whatever, like it's not really just networking. It's actually kind of, you think about creating your kind of circle of artists who you collaborate with, right? Because literally a lot of these, you know, talking about the Yale Mafia is what it is because they are all hiring each other because they knew each other, right? A director gets a foot in the door and gets a big fellowship grant. They call on their playwriting friend who was in the MFA with them and they commission a piece together. Or this playwright gets a big grant and a commission at South Coast Rep and she calls on her friend who was directing her plays in MFA, right? So that's kind of where that is, right? In terms of getting the experience and getting your craft, there's a lot of different ways you can approach that, right? There are a lot of great technical theater programs. If you're going design and technical theater on the East Coast, like in the Carolinas, I've got a lot of friends from there. There's a great design program at UCSD down in San Diego. The other thing that I think, you know, I think is underrated in terms of how you're choosing your school is what city you're in, right? And it's not just like, where do you want to be? Because part of like telling stories is also living your own story, right? That's how you come to understand stories, living your own story. So what do you want to be the backdrop for your story that you're learning, that is informing your experience, right? LA might be the place, and UCLA and USC have great programs, you know, for playwriting and actors. And of course, New York, you know, Boston, the other thing is that you're looking at theater programs that are affiliated with kind of world-class theaters, right? So like, you know, ART has a great relationship with Harvard or?
Yeah,
Harvard. Of course, UCSD has a great relationship with the La Jolla Playhouse. USD in San Diego has a great relationship with the Old Globe Theater, right? So these are all kind of like things that kind of factor into this. And so kind of getting an idea of, you know, and also there's also obviously like all of us talking about kind of non-traditional educations, right? It's like sometimes your education is you started a theater company and you learn things because you have to get it up because your opening night is in 2 weeks. So I better learn lighting design right now, right? And you'll find those kind of those tools. There are other great programs from companies like Oregon Shakespeare Festival that have a great apprenticeship program. Both for technical as well. I don't want to forget that kind of side of that. This is such a multifaceted field that all kind of interplay together. So, yeah.
Thank you so much. Would this be a good career path for an introvert versus an extrovert? And as you said, like the tech jobs, perhaps you're painting a set in the back, you know, you're working with others, but you don't have to like be out on stage as an actor.
I feel like I know a lot of theater artists that are introverts, actually. Even actors that are introverts by nature, but they channel this other thing, or they are able to find this other way of expression, right? I mean,
no, I was going to say the exact same thing, that I know a lot of actors who are off stage, very quiet and very to themselves, writers the same way, but their work on the page, you read it and you're like, oh my God, this is so alive and amazing and crazy, or actors who are just sort of off the walls on stage, but they somehow, like you said, I think they have something where they're able to sort of do something they can't maybe do in every sort of day life, but they sort of are able to do it in this one medium, and sort of that's where they sort of flourish. So for me, it's totally something. But at the same time, I would say a big, like me and Bernardo talk about this all the time, where like a big part of this is, you know, writing is a lot, maybe half my job. The other half of my job is really to go to people's shows, go to readings, go to events, and actually try and meet and talk to people. So like the networking aspect of it is pretty big, and that's how things come through. So like, it's odd one way you can be sort of an introvert, but there is an expectation of you to sort of be involved in the community and sort of be active in it socially, so.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you are an introvert, the way to sort of combat that is by being, like Matt said, even if you just go to people's plays, that means a great deal to someone. Like as playwrights, if you come to my reading, I will always remember that you came to that reading, like, you know, and that will like, that means a great deal to me. And also, I think by being professional and being early and always, you know, treating people kindly, that's the kind of stuff that is more important than whether you're an introvert or an extrovert, because that's the stuff that people, when they go, hey, should I be in Matt's play? I'll be like, no, Matt throws his water bottle at you. No, he did. But you know what I mean? Then like, that's the kind of stuff that's more important. But yeah, being an extrovert helps in every industry, because you can go to a party and go charm some people. You know, like, I wish that wasn't true, but that is very helpful in this industry.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, the thing is too, right, it's like, again, kind of back to this idea of like networking, right? Networking doesn't have to be, I'm going to meet people, right? I mean, one of the things that I've done, I've been in LA for 6 years. Within the first year, I started a gaming group, right? It's just other actors and musicians and people who have come through our theater who are like, oh, you like to play board games, right? Let's just do board games. Much more simpler. It doesn't have to be, you know, but it is. It's about, you know, a lot of this about finding collaborators is about who you jive with, right? You don't have to talk about the biz to kind of figure out what that is. Because there are many times where I'll be sitting there, you know, going, oh man, you just took all my resources, stupid Catan, and you know, and then it'll be kind of, you know, what if we write a musical together, right? Because, you know, because I mean, it is, it's still this kind of lived experience and this kind of building bonds, right?
Yeah, and I think one of the mistakes when you talk about like networking is this sort of like, I think a lot of people put a lot of energy into theaters that they don't even like, and they don't even like their work, right? And it's like, why are you so desperately trying to, like, we all want to make a name for ourselves and we all want to meet people, but also like, look at who's doing the kind of work that you're interested in, that you want to work at, and then go volunteer for that theater company and say, hey, do you guys need someone to run box office? I am turned on by the art that you create. And I think
that's the part of, yeah, of what you're talking about, of see other people's plays, right? You're,
yeah,
looking for people who are like-minded, right?
Yeah, so that you go, like for me in New York, it was, INTAR was this Latino theater company, and I was kind of like bumbling around seeing like bad Shakespeare in New York, and then I walked into INTAR, and I was like, oh my God, there are other Latino people who do theater, and like they tell the kind of stories I like. It wasn't just that it was Latino, it was like, this is my stuff, like this is what I like. I was like, oh, I'm going to hang out in this theater, you know? And that was the beginning of the end. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, thank you. I will pause. Any questions from the audience thus far? Do you have a question? All right. Let me get you the mic.
So I was wondering, what do you do as, you know, like playwrights? Like, how do you like come up with like ideas and things? I'm sorry.
I mean, for me, a lot of mine are sort of research-based, so like me reading the paper or listening to podcasts or just reading any random articles that people send me, like I'll read something and I'm just interested in certain topics, and at a certain point something will catch my eye and I'll be like, oh, that's interesting. This woman did this thing, and it's like the tiniest little mention in the article, but it sparks an idea in my head, and then pretty soon like I'll sort of research that idea and sort of, I basically just keep researching until a story finds its way into my brain. But so me, it's just sort of like taking in mostly nonfiction type stuff, articles, newspaper, essays, things like that. And then something it sounds like I'm waiting for it, but like it happens enough where I'm like, oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. And so just, it sparks ideas for me. So it's really just letting things come to me and then waiting for a little spark to be like, oh, okay, I have an idea.
For me, it's more like I daydream a lot and I'm kind of sit around and think about, you know, ideas. And if I have an idea that I really like, it usually takes me about a year or two to write it, because I kind of filter my ideas, because I have a lot of bad ideas. If one idea keeps coming back and I keep thinking about it and I keep making little notes in my notebooks about it, and it gets to a point where I have to write that play. I think that has saved me from writing a lot of, I have so many bad ideas that I'm very happy I never sat down and wrote.
My big advice actually for you is, well, okay. Yeah. So like stories can come from anywhere, right? It's really just kind of what interests you. I also kind of, for every level of like theater artist, whether design or whatever, I always kind of recommend people take a little bit of improv, because sometimes that skill, that muscle of basically just having to make choices on the spot, can be hugely valuable, right? There are times actually when I was writing a little bit more, where I'd be like, I have a silly idea. Like this would be a cool Star Trek episode, right? So here's this concept of, you know, what if an alien race, you know, started World War II the same way we did, right? And you know, I'm just coming up with something random, right? And then it's kind of like, okay, here's this random scenario. Here's my actor friends. Come on over. Here's the scenario. You're an alien, you know, and you invented World War II. And you start spitballing, right? You start kind of figuring out, or you go, I have a great idea for a character. I don't know what story they're in. Right? So then feed it to another actor friend, right? And then just start putting, okay, let's put that character in, you know, an ice cream shop. What happens, right? As we improv through it, then suddenly we discover, oh, he's got a backstory of why he doesn't like ice cream because he's lactose intolerant. Oh, okay, where does that lead us to? Why is he lactose intolerant? You know, and you can kind of come up with all kinds of random stuff as you keep literally bouncing the ball off the wall, right?
That's a good question. No, that's a smart question. Is your question off of playwriting or other things as well? So I will tell you, my income, I would say 10% of it is playwriting. Maybe even be a large exaggeration. Where's my wife? She'd come here and tell you what it is. But like, I make most of my money acting in commercials, which does not feed my soul. It sells my soul. Playwriting is not a place to make money. That, if that's your question, like, I, like, Matt is, in my opinion, I'm not here to embarrass him, like, one of the best Latinx playwrights alive today. And I don't even think Matt has been produced all over the country, won a bunch of awards. Matt, would you tell someone to become a playwright to make money? No. Like, Matt's where you want to get to. You know what I mean? Like, there's like two playwrights who make money off of playwriting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, you know, the one of the best things of advice I ever got was, I know, there's a lot of people who, there's this artist named Eric Fleischel, who's a sculptor and like a painter, and he had a piece in Rockefeller Center just after 9/11, I think it was called Bodies or Falling Bodies, and it actually got, his piece got taken down, but it was a big deal that he got this sort of commission to do this thing right after 9/11 in Rockefeller Center in New York. And one of this advice he gave me one time was that he felt there was through his lifetime, there's been so many other artists, painters, sculptors, whatever they were, who were much better than him, much more talented than him. But what they didn't have that he had, he thought, was that they were too scared of the, maybe not volatile, but unpredictability of income that artists have. And he got it. It made sense that many people need to have a certain amount of paycheck each year, each month, each year, whatever it is, so they know they're going to be fine throughout the year. They can pay rent, they can support their family, whatever it is. But he was just sort of saying that many of them drop off what they're doing with their art because it's so all over the place, the income you make year to year. Some years it's pretty good and you feel on top of the world. Other years it's really low and you're scared. So he felt that that's something that artists need, is to be able to say, like, I'm going to take this life on, even though the income I'm going to have is going to be all over the map and I'm never going to know where it's going to be next year. So, like, in answer to your question, you know, some years I do okay, and other years I'm literally, toward the spring, like, I need an email to come in to give me some money to do something because I need to, like, pay rent. So, I mean, it's to me, that's the important thing, like, knowing that it's always going to be, even friends of mine who were doing really well, they're doing TV stuff, whatever it is. Like, I have a friend who was on The Daily Show for a few years, got an Emmy for that, was on writing for the Parks and Rec after that. And then she had a lull for about 5 years before she got, I think, How I Met Your Mother. And it was just amazing because she's this sort of celebrated writer who has Emmys. She was on Daily Show back in the Jon Stewart days, and it was this really hot show. And all of a sudden she had this 5 year or so gap where it was just like nothing was coming in. But luckily she saved money and she sort of was all right. But so the income question is funny because it's each year is so vastly different depending on what you're doing. And a lot of my stuff comes from maybe one time a film thing comes through, or one time, you know, a TV thing comes through. And playwriting for me happens to be a little bit more steady, but like there's always odd jobs that come my way and I'm like, oh, okay, and that ends up saving me for the year, whatever it is. And other years I'm doing better, but it's such a weird, like, my taxes are all over the map because, you know, it's random.
Yeah, I mean, it's a loaded question because I know people who are making, you know, a few hundred thousand, you know, annually. I know there are people that are in freelance that are doing like about 30,000, you know. I have a sit-down job at a theater company right now, so I'm in the realm of like 50,000, which is, you know, respectable. But I mean, when I compare to like my same job in, say, the theme park industry, it's like three times that, right? So again, it's not something you go into for the money, but I don't want to say that you cannot make money, right? And part of this is that this field is so diverse that you will end up doing a lot of things. And if you are committed to kind of, you know, I mean, I've kind of gone more the arts administrator realm, right? So I'm kind of, I'm producing and directing less and doing my own art less. And that's how I have the steady paycheck ultimately, right? When I was doing freelance, you know, I'd say 70% of the job was hustling for other jobs, right? And as soon as I got a contract, then it's like, okay, I'm going to spend about 60% of my brain doing the art, and I'm going to spend the other 40% of my brain hustling for the next thing. You know, so it's like, you know, I've lucked out where I've had years where, like, I got a $60,000 grant, right? So it's like you apply to a grant through actually San Diego Public Library, and they were kind of the fiscal receiver, and I got to work with a playwright and commission a new work and develop a piece, and that sustained me for a year while I was doing my other hustles. You know, I'd say, so yeah, and then there are years when it's like, you know, I wasn't, you know, booking any acting, I wasn't, you know, directing any shows, but I was like, getting hired consistently as a freelance stagehand and electrician, right? And those years, actually, I probably got paid a lot better because, you know, it's like, this is another thing too, right? Where there's like, you know, you can still get hired like kind of hourly, you know, W-4 overhire work as an electrician, as a sound technician, as a carpenter, you know, and you're still in the creative field. You're still having to do all this problem solving, and it's certainly a lot steadier. And you're not kind of hustling as much, but you're also kind of in that kind of grind, right? So it's a balance, right? You do have to kind of multitask and multi-disciplinize yourself, so that you can jump from, you know, doing commercials and book that, so that gives you the space to concentrate. Okay, I'm going to spend this next month and just write, right? Or you decide to go the other route and you find it's very rewarding to just be an arts administrator, a producer, a fundraiser, right? These are all kind of important aspects of this, and it still keeps you kind of your foot in the work.
I had a follow-up question to that. What's kind of a week in your life with all the different jobs you all do? Like, if you're screenwriting one week, or you're also doing your playwriting, like you're acting, all the various, what's your week kind of look like? And what are your hours? I know they're all over the place, but.
Which phase of my life? Good God. I mean, for me right now, because I've got the nonprofit job at East West Players, I mean, generally speaking, it's supposed to be 40 hours a week. It ends up being between 50, sometimes 70 hours a week when we're like about to open a show. And then on my time away from that, and then there's like the time that I allocate for my own kind of creative projects, whether it's developing a short film or whatever. So, try and keep a little bit of time for myself outside of that. When I was an actor, it was all over the place, right? Because literally it would be like I'd have three auditions. Like, there'd be weeks where I'd have three auditions a week, two of them in LA, one of them in San Diego. So I'd spend a lot of time in the car. And then I'd come back and I'd sit there for about 6 hours a day, looking at budgets for the shows that I was producing in San Diego. And then, it can range, and this is more to the point of, what we're talking about of, this is something you pursue for your passion. Your work is your hobby, which is both a blessing and a curse, right? talking about we're all kind of representing, to a certain degree of like theater, East West Players is the longest running theater of color in the nation, the largest professional producer of Asian American theater, right? So there's an extra boost of, I got to stay awake another hour earlier and get through this budget because there are actors of color that are dependent on the opportunities we create, right? So there's an extra kind of like motivation there for me, right? I don't know. I've been talking a lot.
I mean, my schedule is the only constants in my life are I have a baby and he wakes up between 6:30 and 7, and that's a constant. And my wife so far has decided to still be a constant in my life, and she's still in my house. So those are the two constants I have. I mean, I have weeks where I don't have any auditions and I write a lot at a coffee shop and, try to write plays and pretend to write screenplays, but I never do that. And then okay, this is just an example of one of my days this week, just because I think it's how insane this industry is. I woke up, I take my kid to daycare, I'm on my way to a coffee shop to write a play, a new play. I sit down to write, I get a call from my agent, you have a last minute commercial audition in Burbank. I live in Santa Monica, okay? So I drive all the way to Burbank. Well, I go home, I shave my face, I go to Burbank, okay? I pretend to be a young dad, sell my soul for 5 minutes, then I start driving back from Burbank. On the way back, I get a call from my legit agent. Hey, you have to put yourself on tape for a cop role for This Is Us, and they need it in an hour. Oh my God. I speed, I get home, I put on my cop shirt that I paid like 10 bucks for these moments of my life. I record the one line, I send it off, and then my baby, we go pick him up from daycare and I'm hanging out with him, okay? Now, this is important just to tell you, this is what you are in for in this career. Yesterday at 8 p.m. at night, I get a phone call. Hey, you booked that This Is Us line, right? Awesome. When does it shoot? Tuesday. Oh, I'm in New York Tuesday for a reading of my play. Oh, well, what are you going to do? I don't know. Cry and drink a lot of wine because I don't know which of the two things mean more to me. So I turned down the one line on the TV show because I care more about playwriting, but it hurt. And that I just tell that story to be like, if you had asked me Monday what's going to happen this week, because there have been so many weeks where none of that happened. So it's all very exciting stuff, but it's also like, why did it happen in 1 week?
I don't know. Matt, do you have an answer?
No, I mean, for me, I think as a freelancer, it's I'm almost doing my best each week to try and convince myself that it's a 40-hour work week. So, like, if I'm traveling or if I happen to be here in New York or my home bases, I try and treat it like I have, you know, 8 hours of work to do every day. So like if I'm traveling somewhere and I have rehearsals, I have rehearsal, then I have rewrites afterward. And so I spend 8 hours of my day working on my play, working on rehearsals on my play. And if I don't have rehearsal that day, then I try and do my best to get up and like spend a couple hours doing email. Then I sort of try and get spend a couple hours doing writing on a couple different projects. So I try best I can to pretend as though I have an office and a day job where I have to be there sitting. When in reality, and many times this happens, I get up and I'm wandering around the house and I'm doing something stupid for most of the day, you know. So it's weird because when you're working, I think, full time still, all you want is time to work on your plays. And like, I wish I could be doing artistic stuff all day long. Why am I stuck at this job? This is terrible. And then you are awarded some of the time. You're like, now I have this entire week of just technically nothing to do. But it's a weird thing to actually force your brain to be like, no, I'm not just going to like go for a drive or go to the beach or like, you know, go play with dogs in the park, whatever, like to actually be like, no, I'm going to sit. I have a job. It's called writing, even though I technically don't have to check in anywhere. But to make yourself check in, I think, is sort of the goal of my existence. So.
Thank you. Audience questions? I know there were a few. All right.
I was going to ask if you had any like regrets about choices that you made to get to where you are.
Question. Ooh, getting real.
You know, that's I could say yes, but it's hard because so much of who I am is everything that I've been through, right? So to forfeit some of that is to forfeit me. Right. So no, you know, it's I mean, there's certainly things that I wonder about. Right. Case example. Right. Like thinking that I was going to go into like design, illustration, whatever, which could have landed me in animation or could have landed me in like theme park design or something like that. And of course, leaving that behind. And kind of focusing on theater. And then little did I know, like, in 2015, I got a random call from an old boss of mine from another theater I used to work at, who was like, Andy, I'm working for Disney Imagineering right now. I've got this project, and I can't tell you about it until you sign this NDA, but you'd be great for this, right? And lo and behold, here I am, like, looking at going into something that I thought I had left behind, you know, 10, 15 years ago. It's funny because, again, like this field is so, you know, you're never ever one thing and you develop all these other random skills that you don't, I know stage managers that have gone on to become entrepreneurs and executives. I know directors that have become, you know, chief creatives for theme parks. I know sound designers who have gone into the video game industry. I know actors that have jumped into every imaginable thing you can imagine, right? Because so much of this, you know, as storytellers, it's kind of your job to kind of put your head into a lot of different things. You do become kind of a chameleon, and you do have the ability to kind of jump in and out of other careers, right? So, I mean, so that was kind of an interesting thing to just randomly take this freelance 3-month gig working for Imagineering and jump into this and put myself into this different headspace that I thought was gone, right? So that was cool, right? I mean, and I think that's kind of one of the fascinating things about, you know, this field, right?
Yeah, because I'd say my immediate answer is yes, many regrets all the time, every day, yeah. But at the same time, what you're saying, like, they all led me in a certain path that maybe I didn't expect to go on. So one thing I really regret happened to turn out, and I met this one person, that person changed my life over here, whatever. But I can think of two very specific examples for me. One is right outside of UC Santa Barbara, I applied kind of blindly to all these grad schools. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know anything about theater. I just wanted to keep studying. And I got into a bunch of schools, but at UCLA, they were offering me a bunch of money to go to UCLA. They were going to pay for tuition. They were going to pay me. They were going to, like, everything was free. Housing was free, whatever. And I really didn't want to go there. I wanted to go to New York. I was dying to go to New York. I'd been there once, and it just felt like that's where I wanted to be just as a person. So at the very last minute, UCLA actually had to call me and be like, we need to know today if you're coming or not because you've held us off too long. And so I was like, yes, okay, I'll be there. So clearly they were already aware that I wasn't, like, dying to go there. But I went there because of the money, purely. Even though I really, in my heart, didn't want to. And then after my first year at UCLA's grad school, they kicked me out at the end of the year. And then I immediately went back to New York, and then I was happy. And then the second example would be that a couple years ago, I decided, because all my friends were playwrights are coming out here to write TV shows. And I was like, oh, I want some of that money also. I'll come out to LA and I'll start working in TV as well. And then I made an ed decision purely based on money. I'm not really a TV person. I like film. I like theater. That's what I care about. But I was trying to force myself to like TV. So I came out here, did the whole run, meetings and all that stuff. And I really didn't like it. It was not me at all. And like, that was another thing. I was like, oh, wait, the minute this had happened, I was like, I thought back to UCLA and I was like, I did that thing again where I made a decision solely on money and it didn't go my way. Just my life didn't turn that way. And I can't say it's a mistake because things have happened since then that weren't positive. But for my own personal thing, I really felt this thing when I've done something purely based on money and didn't have any soul in it, it really doesn't go my way. So I've sort of, in my brain now, I'm sort of thinking if that comes across me again, I'll be like, hold on, let me think about this for a second before I make that decision. So I can't say it's regret totally because a lot of good things came out of both those decisions, but I do regret them, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I have so many regrets in my life, but it's not, my career has been what it is. And I think more of my regrets are like, you know, I should have, just like, I wish I'd known that I wanted to be an actor and a playwright before I applied to universities. I wish I had known that there are certain schools that set you up better for after, you know, but I wasn't in my place in my life to know those things, and I wouldn't have succeeded at those schools if I had applied at that moment in my life. So I think those things happen for a reason. I'll tell you, this isn't a regret, but I early on in my career made my career the most important thing in my life. And I, for example, was on two vacations with my wife, then girlfriend. We were at the vacation and I booked things and I left my wife alone and flew back to New York to do the jobs, the acting jobs. And I think that when I'm on my deathbed, I don't think I'm going to think back fondly on the off Broadway play that I did. I think I'm going to remember the vacations I took with my wife. So what I wish a lot is that I had remembered what are the things that actually make me happy. I mean, because that's what Matt's talking to, right? Like, it's not just a career thing. It's like what actually makes Matt happy is writing plays and film, right? And so for me, it's like this stuff is very important. I care deeply about my career, but you know, my wife and my son are important too. And sometimes you can forget that in these industries.
Thank you. Get the work-life balance. To switch, let me grab you. Mama coming. Oh, I'm coming to you.
If you had, kind of answered that question already for me, but, what do you struggle with like directing and acting? Like, what is your biggest struggles?
It depends, right? Because there are the plays that you. Okay, so like for as a director, like there are plays that you're passionate about, and you like, I've been wanting to work on this play. I know exactly how I'm gonna do this. And then there are the plays you're like, I don't like this play, but someone has asked me to do this. I gotta find a way in, or I gotta find my way in where I can make this mine, or I can say something. And I think that's the does that answer your question? That's probably the hardest thing, right? Of when you have to fit your round peg into the square hole. Or, you know, figure out how to sand down the square hole to fit your round peg. And you know, oftentimes that can be really fortuitous because it challenges you, right? I mean, to kind of think outside your own box, it's very easy to kind of get comfortable in your own kind of creative sensibility. I mean, you know, I didn't do anything. I didn't direct the show, but we just did a production of Mamma Mia, right? Going into it, honestly, I don't think any of us were really excited about the show, right? It's a jukebox musical by ABBA. The story doesn't make any sense. The characters are really, it's really just a vehicle to pump out more ABBA songs. And as we started working on it, like the director, the choreographer, the musical director, and the cast, it was kind of a thing where we were already doing this show with an all Asian American cast, right? Which was already kind of a twist on what is traditionally seen, right? It's usually all white people in Greece. So the process of trying to make this ours, right? To go, okay, well, if this is a Filipino family in Greece, then how does that change how you look at these songs, right? So suddenly, you know, the song Chiquitita becomes Chiquitita, right? And it's referring to kind of an affectionate auntie thing in Filipino culture, right? And, you know, this whole story of this girl who's trying to figure out which one of these three flings that her mom had is her dad, so that she can go off and marry this guy and leave Greece, starts to fall, you know, find tones of, you know, the immigrant experience and, you know, the figuring out what is, like, you know, decisively yours and what you take with you when you leave home, right? Which was really resonant to our audience and to the Filipino community and to our actors. And suddenly we had, like, a really deep show, which we're like, it's Mamma Mia! What the hell? Where did this come from? But, you know, but it absolutely, I mean, you know, this, you know, blew our box office up like nothing else has before. And people came back and people brought their friends because it touched them. Mamma Mia! and it was great, right? Yeah.
I mean, I think the hardest thing for me that I struggle with is in an industry that we all know is not a meritocracy. We know that, but we also want it to be. And we also, I spend way too much time comparing where I'm at to other people. And that leads to nothing but pain and suffering. And I wish that I did that less. I wish that I could go on social media and... Some days I can do it and just be happy for my friends and for people who I don't really know, but I know their names because they're in the same industry as me, instead of sometimes seeing other people's successes and taking it as a sort of F you to my entire existence in life. And that's a really, when I was younger, I didn't have that at all. When I was 21 and I first started doing this stuff, I was just happy for everybody and full of happiness and butterflies and cotton candy. And then, you know, this industry, it takes a toll on you. It really does. If you guys want to do this, God bless you. It's awesome. It's wonderful, but it's also, it's hard. It's a tough life. And so that for me, I wish I did that less, compare myself to other people.
I'll just say from the outside, when I look at careers of actors and directors, one thing that always strikes me is that, like, as a writer, I can always just sit in my room and write. I can do my work. I can actually get stuff done. Actors are rejected every day of their life. They get invited. They have to get invited to come into a room to be rejected. And directors I always find tough because directors have to have a project to direct. So they clearly they can make their own projects and write their own thing and create their own thing. But oftentimes, you know, it's a writer or a producer contacting them and being like, hey, do you want to work on this? So there's a lot of, it's just not as easy sometimes to apply to stuff as a director. And as an actor, it's easy to apply to stuff, but you're going to get rejected every day of your life. So there's, I mean, I don't love being a writer in that sense because it's sort of a weird existence of creating your own thing, but I also don't envy sometimes when I hear actors day to day or when I hear directors like looking for a project. Like, it's from an outside point of view, those are the struggles I see, I guess.
Yeah, talking about getting hired as a director, like the analogy I always use is that what if you were a race car driver, right? And you're like, I could race a Ferrari like no one else could. I'm telling you, I'm a great driver, right? But the other guy owns the Ferrari and he's like, I'm not risking my Ferrari on you. You've never driven a Ferrari before. So you go and you buy a crappy Pinto for $300. You soup up that engine. You put a big fin on it, right? You know, you get the nitro in there and you blow up this Pinto, but you send that thing, you know, trailing around the track and there's pieces of it like left behind, right? I have many bits of Pinto around my track, right? Which trying to prove I can, you know, drive a Ferrari. I haven't driven a Ferrari. I've driven a Ford, maybe. Right? So, you know, still waiting for the Ferrari owner to take a chance on me, right?
I'm going to switch gears real quick, and I'm going to ask about the tech you use. Are there any particular platforms you need to know?
You mean, like, social media stuff? Or, like...
Well, like, when you're writing, what do you use?
I'm very old school, so I write by hand, and then I transfer it to Word. So I know there's a lot of, most playwrights and screenwriters I know use Final Draft or versions of that that are way beyond that, that have all sorts of cool things where they can save their research, or they can, there's all these technical stuff. I can't wrap my brain around that stuff, so I just use a pad and pencil and Word. I've actually started embracing social media more in the last couple of years, where like I will post, if I'm traveling somewhere for my work, I will always post about it, and like I'll sort of hashtag the play, and I feel kind of icky doing it, but enough times someone has contacted me and said like, hey, I saw you were in Texas last week, can I read that play? And so things like that pop up, not that often, but when they do pop up, I'm like, all right, I'll keep doing it. So it does help in that regard. And it also helps me when I see other people, like because sometimes I'm looking for an actor, I'm like, oh, he's not in town, so I know I can't call Bernardo. But it does help just to have a general sense of like, oh, they're doing that thing. I'm curious about that. And I email that person like, I saw you were doing this thing. Like, do they need anyone else? Whatever it is. So like, there's a big, like one of the reasons I think I stay on Facebook at all is because there's a give and take of opportunities that are going on. So.
Yeah, I also write on Word. I will say, I like to format my plays kind of weird and do like kind of, things that I find interesting visually. But I have been told by certain people that they don't even read the play because they think that I like don't understand how a play is supposed to be laid out, because I'm like trying to do whatever, like anyway. So I think it's very important to know like what the rules are before you break them. So I think it's good if you want to write to get Final Draft and like write a play on Final Draft and figure out how that works. And then if you want to do something else, but there's just like a norm going on in the industry that I think it's important to know what it is before you like try to do, you know, other things with it.
Okay, in which aspect? So producer hat on, it's Excel and Word, right? I'm doing documents and contracts with Word. I'm doing budgeting and schedules with Excel. And a lot of that, so like those are kind of base fundamental things. On the kind of technical direction side, you're looking at AutoCAD, right? You're learning computer-assisted drafting, whether it's Vectorworks or AutoCAD. Vectorworks is really important because Vectorworks has packages that are has different applications for specifically lighting, theatrical lighting, drafting, right? So kind of understanding how to kind of render in 3D and in space, those are kind of important things. In the realm of design, I'm kind of whatever medium works best for you. I know designers that do collage. I know designers that sketch. I know designers that, but they also have to be able to draft in AutoCAD or Vectorworks. If you're specifically a sound technician, QLab is a really important thing, because then you QLab is a software that's designed to kind of playlist out different audio elements and how you can layer them and use those for playback for shows. Lighting, it kind of depends. Honestly, the industry standard right now is ETC, which is electronic theater controls. So they have basically kind of computer controlled lighting, which you can download, I think, for free, that they have kind of an offline editor. But pretty much every digital lighting console kind of works off the same principles of command line. What else is there? There's a lot of different things. Oh, and then, of course, becoming popular now is media like video projection, which is harder to get at because you're talking about more specialty software that is like really expensive. Kind of the industry standard, I would say baseline, would be like a software called Watchout, which is specifically designed for mapping and media design. You can do kind of to a lesser extent a lot of similar capabilities with QLab. They have a media like package, but
thank you. That was great.
Yeah, so I was wondering, what was it like starting out, learning how to do all these different things and use all these different programs? I'm asking because I'm really bad at anything digital, so I'm just wondering if that was like difficult for you to learn how to do.
For me, it was fun, right? Because a lot of it was kind of teaching myself as I go, as I was, you know, because we started a theater company, and literally it was, I'm in a lighting design class this week. I'll be ready for, you know, the technical rehearsals the 2 weeks after that. So, you know, so there was a lot of kind of experimentation. I think it really does kind of help, particularly when you're talking about like digital technologies or things on a computer, where you're trying to realize things in physical space, right? As soon as you start having to like physically be hands-on and go, okay, this is how this exists in three dimensions. And then you can go, here's all the information I need to keep track of, right? It's like, okay, this is what's important. All the other stuff is noise, but at least this program can keep track of these elements. Does that help?
I mean, I think I'm not technically savvy or anything like that. But like, for example, I had a theater podcast for a while and I didn't know anything about that, how that worked. But I just like taught myself, and I think was okay with the fact that it was going to take me like a year to be good at it, you know? And I think that's just like with the technical stuff. If you're not good at that stuff naturally, it's okay. And like, it'll be fine, because as long as the quality of the stuff is good, then like I read a lot of plays that are written really well and technically well or whatever, and they suck. So, you know, it's just like, you know, like that doesn't matter so much.
It's also sometimes just the opportunity is, I want to do a podcast. I'm really crappy with audio. I need to go meet someone who's really good with audio and also wants to start a podcast. And then that's where you find your collaborators, right? It's kind of more of that. It's not really so much networking as it is relationship building, right?
And that's true anywhere. This is how this podcast started. Someone in a different department said, oh, I know how to record that. And I said, great, I don't. So, we only have about a few more minutes. I did want to ask, so you all touched upon diversity and the lack of... to be realistic, do you find it being, so in the young adult literature fiction realm, there's a big push for diverse voices, and it's amazing, and it's excellent, and I'm wondering if in your realm there is any push for that, or do you have to create your own, as you were saying?
I mean, I think it's definitely changing. I mean, I would say when I was coming up, there was definitely like, and still exists, an issue of me sort of being pigeonholed as only either a Latinx playwright or a Mexican-American playwright. And I always think of myself as just being a playwright, and all the stories can come from wherever. But right now I would say, like, I also spend a lot of time on committees and stuff like that for different awards or things for playwrights. And so right now there is a big push, though, where they are very much trying to focus on, you know, equity and inclusion and having stories of color, stories in women. So that aspect has changed. But, you know, still, though, when you look at some of the bigger stages out there, I mean, there's many cool companies who do diverse work, but there's also larger companies like Manhattan Theatre Club, for instance, or sort of larger institutions in New York, where they are, if you look at the playing field, sometimes you are still sort of like every year when they announce their season, like, oh, great. Oh, there's a woman in there. Great. You know, so it's still a big issue, but I can sense a little bit from the ground up a little bit where people are actually just trying to aware of the problem a little bit and trying to address it somewhat. But who knows when it'll actually, I think, take place. So.
I'll say two things on it. One is, there's this funny thing happening where there is a push, and so a lot of white people think it's over for them, which is really hilarious to me. I'll have so many white playwrights and white actor friends of mine be like, well, you know, we're just not, like, allowed to be in this industry anymore. And I'm like, only 8% of speaking roles on television last year were Latino, but that's fine. I guess just because we're not at 1% anymore, people feel like they don't have anything. So that's an interesting thing that's happening, because that's like a fight that's occurring. And then, but then there's the other side of it, which is like, I don't know if Matt's felt this way, but as a Latinx playwright, there's a sort of expectation that they want me to write plays, but they want them to be either about the border or about drug war or about immigration. And my plays are not about those things. And so I have even people within my own industry who are trying to open doors tell me, well, we don't like your plays because they're not Latinx. And I'm like, well, I wrote it. So and I was born in Mexico, so it makes it a Mexican play, you know? So it's interesting. I mean, these are complicated conversations that we're all having and we're learning how to navigate, but it's way better than it was 10 years ago. That I'll say.
Yeah. I mean, so I stopped acting maybe in like 2004-ish. And that was for a number of different reasons. One, even then, there was a big push for, so you would see like a lot of like grant funding and foundation money that would be going for diversity. It was all into like, we need more playwrights, we need more diverse voices. And you'd see these playwrights, their plays get funded and they would world premiere, and then that would be end of the play. It would never get a second production because all of this funding went into new works. And if, as soon as it was produced, nothing would happen. So it's done. And then the other, of course, the other aspect of it was, for me at that time as an Asian American male actor, I had a half-life. That is from about 18 to about 30. I can play, you know, kung fu henchman or triad or yakuza. So I'd get a lot of work out of that. And of course, you get to a little point where then you age out of that and you can't be the young punk anymore. And so there's a dearth. There's a dearth for anything until you get about 50 or 60, and then you can play the old man in the park playing the, you know, doing Tai Chi, right? Or the mob boss, right? So that was the thing. So I hit, you know, yeah, around 2004, and I was like, okay, well, one, there's tons of playwrights out there, so I don't feel like I can add anything better than some of these other playwrights that are amazing. I'm a pretty good actor, but I've got a half-life coming up on me, and there's a lot of great actors. What's missing are directors and producers, people who are going to fund, going to lobby for, going to you know, produce and, you know, say, this play needs to get its second production, right? And that's kind of where I started to veer my trajectory. And how I kind of really focus on producing and directing. Sorry, what's the original question again? Yes, right. So where we're at now, right, is that, yes, there's a push. And there are still people who think, you know, that it could be a fad, right? And honestly, I remember, like, you know, when I started my theater company, it was kind of the last time Asian Americans became awesome, right? It was like right after Joy Luck Club and Dragon the Bruce Lee Story. And suddenly we had like three TV shows and like a bunch of movies. And then it just was all gone. It just all disappeared. And suddenly like Yellow Face is a thing again. And I was like, why? What? We did this already. So right now we've got like a great upswing. Crazy Rich Asians is out there. Awkwafina's new movie is out there, and it's greenlighting like more TV shows and right, but it doesn't mean it's done because it can all go away like that so easily, right? So for me, it's kind of like there's a diligence. I think the real difference right now is that, oh, this is why I started the other tangent. But the difference is right now is that we have now, between now and the 90s, was that there are more, when you look at the list of producers or people who are greenlighting projects at the networks and whatever, there are more people of color in those names. When you know, it's all of these diversity programs that have been going on the last 10 years have actually worked, and the pipeline projects have gotten executives into those roles. And that's where kind of the lasting change happens, right? As we've been able to build the case of, look, this stuff sells. There's a whole, you know, 50% of the nation that you're not programming for, and that's the market, right? At East West Paper, we talk about according to census data, 2042 is the year when the nation becomes a minority majority country, right? At which point, we have to ask all of our content creators, including the theater world, which has honestly been slower on this than film and television. Because they are kind of held up by grant money and not by the market, that if you're not cultivating and creating for the market, for the audience, then what are you creating for? You're killing the medium yourself by kind of programming to the same audience you've been programming for 70 years. And why are we doing South Pacific again? why are we doing Miss Saigon again? Right? So.
Well, thank you all so much for joining today. Thank you, audience, for joining. Round of applause. And thank you all so much. September, I believe, 21st, we will have a horticulturist. Thank you.